All right, we'll go ahead and call to order the Stevensville Committee of the Whole meeting for March 21st, 2019. Ms. Tribbency, would you call roll, please?
Mayor Dooley?
Here.
Councilmember Barker?
Here.
Councilmember Holcomb?
Here.
Councilmember Phillips?
Here.
Councilmember Mines?
Here.
Great, thank you. We're gathered tonight to discuss purchasing policy for the town of Stevensville, special event permit ordinance, and protocol for the town of Stevensville's use of legal counsel. So this is just a committee of the whole, not a decision-making meeting, but something where we can go through these policies at the request of the council and review whatever changes need to be made or that sort of information. So we certainly welcome our viewers tonight on the live feed, as well as those of you that joined us in the audience. To get right into the purchasing policy for the town of Stevensville, tonight you've been provided with a supplement that includes highlights, and the cover page has been put together by Ms. Van Tassel to kind of distinguish the changes between two different versions of the purchasing policy. Your packet included a version of the purchasing policy from that was adopted 10-10 of 2014, or rather the 23rd of October 2014, and that was a mistake. You should have received the 4-9-15 purchasing policy. Interestingly enough, I'd like to share with you how that mistake happened, because it's relevant to a decision that the council's just made. When we built the packet for the COW meeting, the clerk went through our records that typically set policy, and that's done by resolution, obviously. We found resolution 361, got a copy of that here, that adopted the original purchasing policy. Then in April of 15, revisions or amendments of the purchasing policy were completed by motion. However, we didn't have any record of that until we looked through some files on some computers and found that that had been done by motion versus by resolution. I guess the reason I'm sharing that with you is to really highlight the importance that a resolution holds in adopting a policy. Because, for example, if you go to our website tonight, if you went on our website and went to our resolution database and said purchasing policy, it would bring up any resolution that had to do with the purchasing policy. The only resolution it would bring up is 361, which would be an outdated purchasing policy, because we amended it since then, but we didn't amend it by resolution. So, you know, when we talk about resolutions amending policies and resolutions amending and rescinding resolutions, that's why the clerk's office and I really recommended having that consistency, so that if it's a different administration coming back, we can look and say, okay, we understand that this was amended. A good example of when it was done properly was with the council rules. We're on resolution, I think, 387C of the council rules. So you can see the progression of changes when you look up council rules in a resolution database. So something for you to consider as we continue to work through this idea of resolutions setting policy, and whether or not resolutions should be rescinded by another resolution or even amended by another resolution. Nonetheless, the purchasing policy is before you tonight, and like I said, we've given you those revisions, and April has compiled this cover sheet to show you what the changes are, and I'd invite her to kind of highlight what those are and discuss that with you.
Okay. They're fairly minimal, and I do apologize. I put on this cover sheet, I put that the policy was amended 4-9-16. It's actually 4-9-15. So the first section that was changed is section 7A3, and that was just a bookkeeping or clerical thing. It looked like that they had the sentence documentation must accompany the claim submitted for approval. They had that sentence in that paragraph twice. So in the revision in 15, they removed the second sentence. The other section that was changed is section 7A4. And in the original version from 2014, everything from $25,001 and up was under one sentence, basically, well, two sentences. In the revision, they broke it into two separate sections and then added another section specific for professional services. So it clarified some things and streamlined the process a little bit by saying, okay, for $25,001 to $79,999, we have to have three written quotes. On vendor stationery, and the documentation must accompany. As opposed to what it says prior, $25,001 and up for auto, trucks, equipment, supplies, construction, repair, and maintenance, all items in this range must follow the formal advertisement process outlined in Montana state law. So that would have been, to my mind, extremely cumbersome. I wasn't under this policy, so I'm glad I didn't have to deal with it. But they simplified it in the revision in 2015. We're breaking it down to where we can do it with just three quotes. And then the $80,000 and up, we have to follow state statute to do all the advertising and everything. And then to get specific for professional services, because that can be different. It's typically by the hour type of thing. So those are really the only changes that were made between the 14 and 15 revisions. And so that's that.
Okay. Any council input? Ms. Barker.
Something that I would like to see change. I know we always go with, for existing vendors, if there's a way that we can, hey, we're doing updates, you know, is there anybody that maybe could come in? Because obviously if this was done in 2015, maybe that has changed some. So maybe putting it out there to everybody saying, hey, this is what we're doing with our policies. Is there anybody that maybe has something cheaper or maybe, you know, because obviously that changes.
Oh, absolutely. And we do kind of try to, particularly, Public Works is, George is really good about kind of putting feelers out and who does what. And like anything, if we have plumbing, electrical, anything like that, I'm kind of calling everybody in the book.
Yeah. Just because I know it says existing. So to me, existing means we're staying with those same vendors that we've had for years and years. So that might be something to think about is, you know, maybe that could change in wording wise. I don't know how we would.
And what it does say is for existing vendors, and if you consider an existing vendor a vendor that we routinely do business with, the supervisor of that department does an annual review of their pricing versus their competition to make sure that that pricing is accurate or
but
know, is fair.
But is it really getting done? I mean, just that's a question.
Absolutely.
Especially, like I said, George is really good about knowing who's new in town kind of thing. There are some things that we only have one vendor in the state that does some of the stuff that we need to have done, so obviously we can't do it. We really do try to, because we're aware of the dollars being spent, so I really do try.
Well, and given maybe a new business that's coming in, an opportunity
exactly
to be
right.
able to... To look at that too.
Yeah, so. And Janelle is awesome in the police department, looking around to see where she can get the best deal on anything. So, yeah, it's not specifically spelled out, but we just kind of out of, because we're penny pinchers, we do that.
Right.
And then you've got to look too at reliability.
Right.
You know,
correct.
Look at vendors.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, we'll try a new vendor and not real thrilled about, and so we cross them off our list, so we'll call them again, kind of thing. So, we're constantly watching the bottom line.
Something else I had was meal purchases, because I know we had established different meal.
Yeah, we have to change
on it, so that should be changed as well.
Yeah, and there is a section in there regarding credit card purchases that I would recommend being changed. We've kind of changed it internally, but it was never documented that. Credit card information should not be stored on any online vendors.
It's in our fiscal policy.
I know, but I thought that would be interesting. Just because it's mentioned in here, there is a section on credit cards. I would just like to have that to CYA.
I don't think it's smart to leave them in there, especially with all the hacking going on.
Exactly, and it's gotten worse. Our credit card, the town's credit card, has gotten hacked twice since I've been here. And so... You know, and like I said, we do it internally. I've told all the department heads, don't do that anymore. But I would just recommend we include that in the policy.
Okay. So yeah, because what we changed, the per diem was $25 a day.
But it's still kind of broken down a little bit by state policy. But yeah, that does need to be updated. I know that today too.
I think in that case, per diem should just be referred back to the personnel policy manual, because we updated it in there.
Right.
And instead of every time updating per diem and updating it in three different places, we should just update it in one document and all other documents refer to that.
Sounds good to me.
Is that fair?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Other remarks? Mr. Thomas.
I'd like to ask that we have a section in there. If we have something maybe break down, that we don't have to wait 2 to 3 weeks for a council meeting and then for it to be ordered, maybe we can call and pull each one of you, get your opinion, and then if you all say okay, then we can get the equipment as long as we have the money, for one. But I know at one time we had a major piece of equipment breakdown, and the mayor told me, you call each one of the council people and ask them, I cannot give you information. So I did, and they all said okay, and then I got back to the mayor, and we were able to get that equipment. It wasn't anything that was, you know, approved ahead of time for the budget or anything. It was just something that happened. And I would like to see that you all agree that that would be something we could do in the future.
And I'm fine with that. I mean, as long as we could get a heads up and
right.
and be known about it, I'm fine with that.
And I think, it, like you said, maybe some type of wording in there that, hey, if something goes, these phone call could be.
Because there may be things that internally we would deem an emergency, and we would like to relax the purchasing policy because internally we feel it's an emergency, but it's not something where we're going to do an emergency declaration on, you know. The critical piece of equipment fails, you know, if a pump fails at the well house, which has happened, we move on and we repair the pump because that's something we need to do for fire flows. But it's not something where we would declare an emergency community-wide because a pump failed. And that's, I think those are the types of circumstances where we're asking to say, okay, this year when the pump failed, we had the spending authority in the budget. Sometimes that won't always be the case, and so we need some sort of provision that says, you know, when it's deemed by the executive that this is in the interest of public safety and welfare, that we move forward on that with some sort of communication plan so that the council is aware of that decision. Further comment?
So have we always had the two written quotes? I don't know where I keep hearing three written quotes.
Three is $25
one. Okay.
And up to $79,999. But $1,501 to $25,000 is just
two. Okay.
And we've always done that. Right. I know I said most department heads, but you can do it anyway.
No, if it's a specific vendor that we can only get it from.
That's yes.
One quote.
Right, yeah, there's a sole source provision.
There's a sole source, you know, like our pumps down there, there's a sole source.
Yeah.
And that's Eagle Pump, right?
What's that?
Is that Eagle Pump?
No, that's the guy that we use to pull our pumps.
Oh, pull pumps. Okay.
I mean the sewer plant pumps. You know, they're from a flight company, which is in Switzerland. There's really no way we can change, but it's going to cost a ton of money because all the plumbing has to be changed, you know, to fit these different type of pump. They're not all interchangeable. Mm-hmm.
And in the policy, there's two criteria for sole source purchases, and one of those being that there's only one source for that supply or service item, and the other being that maybe only one source is acceptable or suitable for the supply. Service of the item. So, you know, there may be cases where the town is only willing to do business with one vendor for whatever reason, because of the continuity, for example, in our systems, and that may be, you know, for example, our technology vendors. We want them to have a good, robust knowledge of our IT systems, mm-hmm. and especially the systems down at the sewer plant that are more automated. And so we'd select one vendor. There are multiple vendors that could service that, but we would select one vendor because of their institutional memory of that facility and how those pieces interact with each other, so that somebody that we're not paying someone by the hour to come in and relearn our entire system just so we can get it fixed cheaper. Long run, that won't serve us well.
And that's the problem with the water system. It's one person that can work on it, and they're in Kentucky.
Right. And we're considering doing a changeover so we can find somebody more local to work on that for us. Because if we need somebody to come on site to work on that system, we're paying someone to come from Kentucky.
Yeah. Was this just an oversight when that was installed? That
that's what the engineers, you know,
put in
at the time. We didn't realize that it was a sole source company to work on at that time.
Wow, that makes it difficult for. You guys,
yeah, and there's
especially
been
that phone over the phone, and that's
And we've done some of that. I did some of that a couple of weeks ago. We got things taken care of. But the system gets old enough now that we may want to, when we if we do a water project, upgrade it all to what we've got a sewer plant that can, you know, be worked on by different technicians.
It doesn't happen very often, you know. Like with up the airport, we had an issue with the AWAS system. The people who maintain it on behalf of the FAA are, what, out of Maine, Massachusetts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back east someplace.
And they have to work three times a year. It costs us a fortune for them to do an hour and a half work. So Denton?
Don Lorenzen.
Don Lorenzen got certified so he can do two of the three. So we found a workaround there, but that other company still has to come from back east to do the certification.
Once a year.
Yeah.
Versus three times a year.
Right.
Now, is that a problem with all of the areas that here, that there's just that one person?
So I think that one person comes out once a year, essentially, and hits all the airports.
Yeah, so and we share in the cost, but it's still a big chunk of change. Sometimes you still have a choice.
Okay. Any further comment on the purchasing policy?
I'm going to rewrite this.
So, I think we've got the record to reflect the changes that the folks have requested, and April can accommodate those into the document, and then we can bring that back for council's consideration at a future meeting.
Okay. Yeah, I can have ready for the 11th meeting.
Okay. I think Robin.
A resolution.
Didn't Robin first suggest a change on this?
Yeah, Robin was certainly the one that, Ms. Holcomb was the one to bring it forward for consideration.
Yeah, so just go through, everybody go through and if they felt okay, or if you didn't want to make any changes, or.
I'm just wondering if maybe Robin might work with April and
absolutely.
Put those changes together.
Sure. We can do it by phone.
That's helpful.
It's, but yeah.
That might be.
Certainly when we start changing these documents, when we start modifying these documents, it's easy for those of us who deal with it every single day to become blind to what we don't see. And so it's great to have a second set of eyes, such as a council member, to look at that and go, oh, we missed a typo here, or, oh, there's two sentences in the same paragraph, whatever that may be.
Yeah.
That's great.
Okay.
Right. I mean, it's good to just start pulling, you know, I'm not pull everyone out at once, but, you know, to pull them out once in a while and make sure you don't need to make changes or add or take away or.
And something like this, make sure, is it realistic to do what we're being asked to do?
Right.
Okay, and the revisions that we make in this policy will come forward in the form of a resolution, so we're clear, because we don't want to have another mishap where we have the wrong document before you as under consideration.
We've got 361A.
All right, are we okay to move on then? Next item up is the special event policy, or excuse me, special event ordinance, rather. And the relevant information is in your packet. Get with me and catch up. Specifically, I think It appears special event ordinance was really established as most recently as 2008, and then it's been revised a couple of times since then. And the most recent revision appears to be in 2015, when we changed some verbiage so that events with 1,000 people or less and not requiring an alcohol permit could be approved administratively. And those events more than 1,000 people and or requiring a alcohol permit would have to come before council for approval before those events permits were issued. Ms. Holcomb.
And I think that's where I want to see taken back out. I don't think any time that the council had to approve the special permits, we never denied anybody. I don't even think. But I found a couple of them that we weren't aware of until we asked about them, and you sent us copies of them. I know personally there was more than 800 people at a Parade of Lights, and they only put under 1,000. I mean, I don't know if they're doing that just so they could get it through instead of having to come to council. But I just think they should all have to come to council, through council. I mean, we've never denied any of them. And it's always been that they had to have it in within 30 days of the event. I mean, that was the only thing that I would see different in this.
There was one, two, that I had seen in there. You might want to look at it, too. There was a thing that says 14 days prior to mm-hmm. the event, too. Yet this says 30 days prior, so we want to make sure that that's...
That they're...
Yeah,
let's see where I had it at. We certainly, I think, in an administrative way, we have some issues with our event permit, the actual form, that we'd really like to overhaul that form and make it a little bit more streamlined so that folks could submit these online and submit the documents they need to electronically and kind of make that form more consistent. The clerk hasn't had an opportunity to really undertake that project yet. And so that's why it's not been done. Ms. Tribbensee, do you want to add?
Yes, Mayor and Council members. I would like to see a change to get more information. I'm used to a system where we know there's going to be porta potties and more specific information, like where on a site plan are you going to do this, where it helps you in the decision-making process. Right now, it's not required that some of these things are included on the site plan, and I think it would be useful if we could just include a few more things that might help in deciding or not.
More better, I think.
There's also an opportunity here where we certainly don't want to burden the folks who hold events in our community by any means. But all we're right now charging for the event fee is $25. And an event typically, especially if it's held at one of the parks or it's held in the public right-of-way, and that's usually where we issue permits, it impacts our organization more than just the $25 that we collect to process the application. And a good example of that is when we have events down at the park, generally our garbage cans are overflown mm-hmm. and we have to pay Bitter Disposal to come in and do an extra dump in order to empty our garbage cans because we have such an impact. And, you know, there are times where we may have to dispatch public works or law enforcement in order to control streets or to get signage out. Mm-hmm. Street closer signage is another thing. Electricity is another thing where sometimes there's a use of electricity and the event holder doesn't always. We don't have a process in place to say, if you use electricity, we'd like to charge you for that electricity. We just have these one-on-one arrangements with each organization who uses electricity, if that's the case. So I think that there's a restructure that's needed with our event, our special events as a community. And certainly I think starting with a form of here's the information we need and then figuring out what cost effects those events have on the organization so that it's not burdening the broader tax base, but that event is starting to kind of pay for itself, not necessarily as a revenue generator, just to reimburse us for our costs that we incur, you know, that are out of the ordinary. But that's what we're looking for. We're not nickeling and diming.
The fee? So what's your proposal on raising the fees to?
We don't know that yet. We'd like to do a better analysis of you know, the events, we'd like to take a, you know, a couple years worth of event permits, analyze those and go, okay, what services did these events use that we're not recouping our costs on to some level? And it's not necessarily to get us to a break-even point on staff time or anything like that, but if there are out-of-pocket expenses like trash, then maybe if trash service is needed, they check a they say, yes, I need trash service. They check that box on the application, and that's an extra $10 or whatever that case may be. So the base permit may be one fee, but then if they want to add things on, they could keep, we can keep charging them if they need that. Audrey?
Yes, from my experience, one of the things you can do is issue conditions of approval. So you, you can offer them the ability to remove the trash themselves, and, or that if they want to use our in-house staff, there's going to be whatever fee, an hourly fee associated between $10 an hour, whatever council decided. But conditions of approval would spell out if a police officer has to come to your event because of a situation, then the town reserves the right to charge whatever, $25 an hour in that case. So you can have those spelled out through your ordinance. That's a way to handle it too.
Ms. Barker.
Just a quick analysis. Last year with Farmers Market gives a prime example, being there every Saturday. There were several Saturdays where the garbage can was full before we even came. And so that's something, and I have offered in the past too to pay for the electricity that we use on that post. And I know we were doing it for a while and then I didn't see anything else on it. So, but, and I, and we have no problems with paying that for that,
sure,
because we do have a DJ that uses the power. Every once in a while we'll have a vendor that will use that power as well. Mm-hmm. So,
and that's a
and
case.
Every one of the vendors are, and it's in our guidelines that they are responsible for their own trash cans. They, you know, to bring, sure, whatever in front of their booth to take care of. They sell food. They have to have it and to dispose of it themselves, not to dispose of it in those garbage cans. Mm-hmm. So
in the case of power, I think, you know, if they're going to use electricity that's owned by the town essentially, then I think that that's just something where we flat fee it, because it's difficult for us to gauge on the meter. You know, we're not electricians, and so we don't necessarily read the meter and then calculate how much of the bill you owe, especially like in the case of Farmers Market. There are so many different events that use that specific power source outside of Farmers Market, you know, the parades and Western Heritage Days, and so there's a whole bunch of other pieces to that. So if it's just easier, I think, for us to just call it a blanket fee if you use electricity to recoup our cost on that, and then we're not worried about how much electricity you necessarily use. You just, mm-hmm, you know, hopefully it'll come out, right, and work out. So,
I hope it doesn't come down to where we're charging for a little meter on electricity.
That no, and that's exactly, well, and we don't want to do that. I don't want to send George down to the power meter every time we have a special event and write down, well, what's our meter cost?
Well,
it's just easier to charge a flat fee and say, here's, you know, it's $20 to use town's electricity, and if everybody who uses electricity pays $20, then it should all come out whether they use $20 worth of power or not.
And I know last year we had talked about another power source,
right,
towards the other end of town.
And these special event fees would help fund those improvements. And that's my vision, is that if these fees could fund improvements and maintenance on these facilities that we're offering, you know, there may come a day where we're going to need some maintenance on the electrical system at 3rd and Main. Obviously, with the Christmas lights and all of the other electricity that system uses, it's going to need improvements. And so, you know, if we need to replace something there, these special event permits could help compensate for that cost.
I'm just wondering, are there other communities that use a special event permitting system?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can look at what their forms look like.
And I think Hamilton has their special permit out on their website. Where you could go look at it.
Okay.
I have never looked on it, but they have their permits and their and a couple other things where you just click on and you can fill them out there.
What I'm thinking, you know, is looking at other cities, communities, mm-hmm, and see what they do and maybe, mm-hmm, implement some of that in our community.
Let's implement this till after next year so I can pay my $25.
Well, I think that there's going to be, you know, we talked about this, we have this issue. Not necessarily an issue, but our ordinance requires that a fee be paid when an alcohol license is issued by the town. Well, in theory, that should apply to every organization, nonprofit, that asks for a liquor permit. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the Highland Games. They came to us and said, we have a liquor license and we'd like to use a liquor permit at the park. And so in theory, we should be charging, I think, the $250 fee to that organization to issue a city liquor license. Obviously, we're not going to do that on the first bat. We're going to warn them and say, our ordinance says we should be charging you, but we realize we've had a long history of not charging you, and so next year expect a charge. We may do that with our special events as well. The new events, they're going to be, they won't be grandfathered in, but Farmers Market will be, hey, we've reorganized this, and so in order to ease that burden on the organization, be aware that our special event fees have changed. So that way we're not gouging anybody. We want to, you know, we want to encourage these events. We don't want to suppress them. So I think in regard to the 1,000 people limit and whether or not that comes to council, I think the intent at the time when they removed that was is to just, you know, to get these, not necessarily to rush these permits through, but to just administratively approve the permits so that the council wasn't necessarily down in the weeds on those things. What we could do with the new form is ask for verification of attendance so that there's some, because right now we have no way of verifying how, you know, how many people attend an event. And you know, for the example of the Parade of Lights, well, maybe 800 people attend the Parade of Lights, but there happens to be 1,500 people in town that night at the same time. And so do you count those other 1,500 people that are just in town to visit shops, not necessarily there to do the Parade of Lights? So I think if we ask for some verification of how many people do you expect at your event, please provide backup documentation, then that justifies whether or not that needs to come to council or not.
Well, that was... it was that one and...
Scarecrow?
The Scarecrow Fest that I was like, okay, I know on these two, there's definitely over 1,000 people. No, hands down, there's always... And then when I only seen 800 on both applications, I went... I know there's more than 800.
And that organization specifically for Scarecrow, they've instituted a process where they're counting the people with, you know, they're actually head counting and finding a, you know, they have a formula to figure out how many people attend the entire event. We are aware of that process, and so we can ask them, please verify how many people are actually attending so that this permit is put through the correct process.
Change it to
500.
Yeah.
Well, could be something to think about too. Is, like you said, change the number on it. Go with a lower number and say, hey, this is.
The man recovered that way, the lower number.
Because you know there's going to be more than 500.
That's right. Mm-hmm. If you do it at 500, then.
The only exception to that would be the Easter egg hunt.
Yeah.
Because I think they're less than 500, weren't they?
They indicated 100.
100 people, mm-hmm. Yeah, for the Easter egg hunt. I think they count the people under 4 feet as half.
It sounds good.
You're a third. Yeah.
I mean, they've always, I mean, before we changed it and they came through council, I mean, they were just quick. I mean, we may have had a couple questions because usually the whole packet's there and we just go through it and it's just quick. You do new and you're done. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would really like to see them come back through just so we know what's going on and what's coming through. I mean,
and then add a benefit, you know, updating the form, get more information. Mm-hmm. I think that would help us, you know, make a decision a lot quicker also.
So if it's okay with the council, to proceed from here, I think we'll get this on the in the queue for, because really the clerk's office is the one that facilitates this process, and she has some ideas in order to help with this process, and her experience I think will lend us well. So if it's okay, I'd like us to defer, put it in the queue as a project for the clerk's office to work on, and when she has some drafts pulled together, we can bring those back before council. Does that work? Is that acceptable to the clerk? Thank you. Paulin told you. All right, we're okay to move on.
I'm good.
Protocol for the Town of Stevensville use of legal counsel. Ms. Holcomb.
I just think this just needs to go away. This resolution just needs to, I mean, I think we, what is the state? Is that what Brian always says, that there's a state law that we already have in place?
Actually, this is put in place so every council member, a few administrations ago, and Pat Groninger and them were on council, I guess. Mm-hmm. You were on there. There was just a lot of bickering between council members and mayor. And I mean, it was just really bad. And every council member was calling Brian.
Brian wasn't our attorney at that time.
Well, I mean,
but and it wasn't, and it wasn't every council member.
Well, I'm just saying, Brian was telling me, and he said that.
Well, do you remember Keithy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it went put it back to Keithy too.
Yeah.
About calling Keithy.
And that's where he. That's where Councilmember Michelson is going. Yeah. I mean, it was during when Keithy was our attorney, and it was. It was said that one council member and the attorney were was making too many calls. But I think we should be able to, if we have a question, to be able to ask our attorney without having to go through the council president or the mayor, just to ask him a question. And then we get this big...
So, just to clarify, are you seeking to pull out Resolution 281A or 281, or both? So, to give you some history, 281A is a revision of 281. And what 281 said was, I'm paraphrasing, 281 was more restrictive than 281A. 281 basically said, if the council wants to contact the attorney, then that item needs to be placed on an agenda. If a council member wants to contact the attorney, that item needs to be placed on an agenda, and consent of the entire council must be given before that person proceeds to contact the attorney. 281A loosened that restriction a little bit to say, well, instead of coming to the full council for permission to ask the attorney a question, instead, why doesn't that council member go to the council president with that question? To verify or to help keep the costs of the attorney in a reasonable limit, that council president should contact the mayor and make sure that the question hadn't already been asked and been answered, right? So we're not paying for the same answer twice. And then from there, if it hadn't been asked or answered, then the question was forwarded on to the attorney for an answer. But I think the intent of loosening, they loosened the rules with 281A, but they also kept some restriction on, and I think the intent there was is to control the cost of the attorney. Now, in the beginning of my tenure, 281A became very, very lax, and I for one, wasn't a stickler on 281A, and for the most part, I think the council president had free rein to contact the attorney as he chose. In January, when I pulled back after we had some expense with hiring another attorney for a personnel issue, in order to meet our budget goals, 281A was reinforced. And at that time, our attorney fees suddenly dropped down to almost $300 a month, which is almost a third or a half of what they had been previously. So I do think the 281A, when it's enforced as a cost-saving measure, it's entirely up to the council as to how much you want to pay for the information you need. And either way isn't bad or indifferent. It's just a matter of, is the information worth the money you're going to pay for it? Ms. Holcomb.
So I know Brian has brought this up a lot, that he wanted us to go through this. So what is his concerns about this then? Because
I can answer that. He said basically what Brandon just said, basically, you know, different verbiage, of course, but he would like to see us go back into the fold, as Brandon said last year, due to everybody and all that crap that was going on, that it got lax. I was calling, and Raymond called, and, you know, Brandon was talking to him. Brandon can talk to him any time, and that's part of the executive privilege, being a mayor. I mean, he has a problem, we don't know, call him. I never did seek approval from Brandon, you know, per 281A. And Brandon makes a good point. You know, like, if I call Brian for something, Brandon might already have the answer. But the only thing Brian thought that he, also the chain email thing, you know, like, if you had a question, Bob, could you forward this to Brian? I would forward to Brian, spread it all out. He called it spread emailing. And that way we're all on the same page. When he sends it back, it just CC to everybody. So we're all in the same mold of what's going on.
Okay.
And also he would like to, he stressed today that he would like also to see the communication come back between a mayor and the council rep and him once a month. He thought that was very positive. And even though that Brandon and I might be at odds at some things, that, you know, at least he thought we were talking again. So he stressed that today very much, that he would like to bring that back to the table.
I think the biggest challenge Brian has, Brian will work with whatever process the council undertakes. If you decide to go back to 281, he will work under 281. His struggles are that we have a resolution in place that he's bound by contract to utilize, and he has a hard time. It puts him in an awkward position when we have a policy in place, but then, you know, we don't necessarily follow that policy. And then it puts him in an awkward position to say, well, Brian, you need to follow the policy, but then a council person calls him and asks for advice, and he's got to be the guy who says, well, you really need to run this through the council president and the mayor's office before I can answer it. That's what Brian's trying to alleviate. Now, if we all acknowledge 281A is what it is, and we all follow 281A to a T, I think that Brian's concerns, for the most part, are addressed. But it's completely up to the council as to how 281A works, and if there's a 281B where maybe you funnel all your questions to the town council president, and so that there's some sort of central source of information, and I'm not included in that as far as saying, has this been questioned or not? Mr. Phillips?
Just a word. I've had several constituents call me about this issue before when it's come up, and from these constituents, they stated to me, you know, indeed, the attorney fees got out of hand way back when, and they like seeing this policy in place. It's a very good policy. You know, it keeps the cost down. And in regards to the president and the mayor and town council meeting on a monthly basis, I think that's a wonderful thing to do. I attended one of their meetings with them once, and I think it's very productive, because they can get together and hash out things, and with the attorney there, and it's very productive. So I think that should continue on a monthly basis.
Alternatively, if the council feels like they need access to an attorney and they don't necessarily want to undertake revising a resolution, or they want to do it in a more cost-effective way, we could certainly ask the attorney to attend one meeting a month where there's a Q&A session with the attorney. So if you have an issue, you know that at the second meeting of the month that the attorney will be there, then you can bring those questions or have that placed on the agenda or whatever that may be, so that you have that opportunity to do so. I wouldn't necessarily say that he needs to come to both meetings a month, but we've kind of reformatted our department reports. We've had some concerns with the department heads. They're challenged in getting the reports, and depending on which meeting they fall on. So we've pushed all department reports or administrative reports to the first meeting of the month, so that they can, or excuse me, the last meeting of the month. Is that correct, Audrey?
First.
It's on the first week. Sorry, I'm getting them confused. All the department reports are coming to one meeting a month, so that they can report on the previous month, and they don't have to report on, you know, a month lapse where they're reporting over 2 month periods. And that was easier for them to pull their reports together. So the other meeting of the month should be a bit condensed, because we won't have to go through those administrative reports. And so we'll agendize those agendas so that the time is balanced, where we'll put some quicker items, where we'll have more administrative reports at the first meeting, and then those items that we maybe need more time to discuss, we can put on that second meeting. So if that's something where you feel it's good to have the attorney present at the meeting, he's willing to come, you know, as long as we inform him that he needs to be there. So that's an option as well, and that doesn't necessarily need to be delineated in a resolution.
Okay.
Mr. Michelson.
Just to be safe to cover our butts, for council rules and have an agenda item, because that would be something that would have to be an agenda item to discuss him with, correct? He couldn't just be here, we couldn't have a question and answer with him off the record.
Right, unless you put something on the agenda ahead of time and say, well, I know that the attorney's going to come to the second meeting of the month, And so I'm going to make sure that if I have an agenda, if I have something I want to ask him or I have something I want to discuss with him, I put that on the agenda so that he's available to answer that.
So you're saying that you would like an attorney there at the second meeting of every month?
I'm offering that as an option to the town council.
Because I thought he kind of wanted to go home. That's how he told me, you know, I don't need to be at every meeting. You guys are old hands.
Right. I mean, there was a day where, and some municipalities still operate, where they require their city attorney at every meeting of the council, whether it's a COW meeting or a full council meeting, they pay whatever rate it is of their attorney to come to those meetings. And right now we're under a contract basis where we pay by the hour if we utilize the attorney. There are some communities who salary their attorney and bring them on as an employee, and that attorney receives a salary for whatever work they provide, and they may work 60 hours one week and they may work 2 hours the next week. It entirely depends. So I don't know if this attorney is, or if Brian is willing to, for that arrangement, or if we do have an RFP drafted because Brian's contract is up in June. Or at the end of June, we have an RFP drafted to re-advertise for legal services to make sure that we have
the best. It gives every attorney
a chance to serve us, and so that may be something that you want to consider in that RFP. Is that how do you want to compensate your attorney? Do you like the contract setup? Would you rather salary somebody? Would you rather just pay them hourly as an employee? How would you like to do that? That's a question that needs to probably be answered. And then, how do you want your interaction with the attorney to look? Do you want it to be at a meeting? Do you want it to be run through certain offices? Do you want it to be a free-for-all? However that looks, that's up to the council to establish.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of a... It's all a cart where you can kind of pick whatever options you want and build that as long as you're, I think, to Jerry's remarks, that you're being conscious of the cost that's associated with legal services. Legal services are expensive. There's no way around that. But you pay for as well, meaning that legal advice can sometimes is good money spent when it'll avoid more money being spent down the road in litigation. Right? We don't want that.
Okay. Does that answer my questions?
Mr. Michelson?
So, what is your feelings as far as the executive end, as far as Brian? Are you comfortable with him being a city attorney? Are you comfortable with him with the salaries and the time that you're putting in? Because obviously, from your end, you're going to be doing more with him. It's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Without going into a full review of the attorney and a performance evaluation, I do defer a number of legal matters to Brian, because there are cases where he has the knowledge base where I don't, certainly when it comes to certain legal areas. But also sometimes it's easier there may be a case where a letter needs to be sent to somebody who we're in some sort of correspondence with. Brian will give me that option to write the letter myself. Oftentimes, I'll say, no, Brian, just write the letter, because my schedule and my time don't necessarily allow me to just sit and write down that letter. It's easier for me to just express my views of what he needs to say in the letter and then let him write it. You know, now at $85 an hour, I'm conscious of, you know, what letters I'll have him write versus what correspondence I can have in-house staff write. But I'm also conscious of my own time that I'm putting into the position and what I'm getting out of that. So.
Okay.
Is there a specific direction that the council wants the administration to take in regard to 281A, or do you guys need some time to sleep on the conversation and then come back?
I think what Brian had was a good idea. The only thing I have is sometimes it's good that we double up to, I mean, we communicate, there's a lot of times, though, that something just comes up out of the wind, where you guys have just asked me, and I know he doesn't have the answer because it's from the legislature, man. Brian says you don't call very often. Of course, I called my last year because of all the crap that was going on. But he said as far as this year, he would like to pull back a little bit, spend more time with his family. But he told me today on the phone, and again, he reiterated, us three here, you know, you've been here forever. Her and I are old hats, now going on our fourth year, so we're starting to see things the way it works. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that he, unless you really need me at meetings, he told me today, I would rather spend time with my family.
I'm happy with just staying with...
Would we all, though?
Yeah. I'm happy with them staying just, with what we have.
He just wanted us to get tighter reins on the policy that we have now. It got a little lax, so that way, like Brandon said, the fees went up. So we could tighten in the reins on the fees, hopefully it gets down to a reasonable fee.
Okay.
And I don't think with this town, unless it really explodes, we could ever afford a full-time attorney. It just can't.
I'm good.
I'd just like to see where the three of you, Brian, Council President, and the Mayor, get together at least once a week or whatever it was.
Once a month.
Because
he doesn't charge us for the second and fourth meeting that he comes in to do jury duty or court duty. So he's, you know, sits for an hour with Brandon or a half hour. An hour with Brandon, and I come in the second half hour and sit with him. Because the first half hour, they might have personnel issues. But of course, I wouldn't want to know.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah,
thank you.
Okay, anything further on legal counsel?
No.
All right, that concludes the business portion of the agenda. We'll open it up for public comment. If you plan to speak, please step to the podium, state your name and address for the record, and please make sure you sign the sign-in sheet at the counter. We've been a little lax on that. Going once, going twice. All right, and if there's nothing further, we'll adjourn. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.